The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Pastor Mike, good afternoon. Welcome to Man in Line on Manx Radio. Today, Thursday, it's all about Manx Care. Manx Care hardly seems to be ever out of the news. All sorts of issues and pressures and things that impact on Manx Care. And Chief Exec Teresa Cope is with us today. And she's accompanied by Afric Edwards, who is the manager of fostering and adoption. Well, why? Well, I'll tell you. Well, because Manx Care is health and social care. And that's the bit that often gets overlooked. In fact, oh, Fastamai, hello, Teresa.
Hello, okay. Hi.
And Afric, how are you?
I'm very well, thank
Jolly
you.
Good. I was going to say, Teresa, we often get bogged down in talking about health an awful lot and social care. I get lots of phone calls after the show saying, why didn't you talk about this? Why didn't you talk about that? And it's very apposite, very appropriate that Afric's with us today, because last time a lady called Margaret phoned me and just said, what's happening with foster care on the Isle of Man? Because it's a kind of a Cinderella service. It goes under the radar. Mm. And yet for the people who are involved in it, the children, the young people and the foster carers, this is not just a job, it's a way of life. So how is foster care on the Isle of Man?
Yeah, so we've made some really good progress, and thank you, because it is really important we get the opportunity to talk about this and to talk about a very important part of the organisation, which is social care. So we have made some really good progress in attracting foster carers, but there is always a need for more. And this is one of the most important roles in our communities, and so important for those young children who need to come into care to have that supportive, safe, loving environment. So it was really important that we shone a spotlight on this today as we head into Foster Care a Fortnight in May, but also for Afric to talk a little bit more about the importance of that service here in Manx Care.
Okay, Afric, what's Foster Care Fortnight all about?
So Foster Care Fortnight's a national campaign that runs every year, and it really is about shining a spotlight on foster carers and the integral work that they do. So this year's theme is This is Fostering. So over that fortnight, we celebrate the carers that we have with us. We have roadshow events where we're out in the community. People can come along and speak to us and ask any questions if they'd ever thought that fostering might be for them. It gives us an opportunity to get together with the children who are in foster care and run events specifically for them. So we've got a couple of different fun days planned. And it's just really raising awareness around fostering, and it's this targeted fortnight.
Okay. In layman's terms, what's the difference between fostering and adoption?
So fostering is looking after a child for usually a short period of time, although we can have long-term fostering arrangements, and adoption is a permanent placement. So that's a permanency plan for a child who can never return to their birth family.
What type of people become foster parents?
Anybody over the age of 21. There's no upper age limit. So a lot of people have asked me, oh, I couldn't foster. I'm heading towards retirement. Well, no, you can. There's no upper age limit as long as you're fit and healthy. So anybody who is 21 or over can foster.
Okay. That's very quick. Obviously, there's a lot more to it. I would imagine there's a form or two to fill out and what have you. It's not something you can kind of dip in and dip out of as well. This is a commitment, isn't it?
It is a commitment, but actually we do have carers who offer short-term or respite care, or we do have carers who are mainstream foster carers who maybe can't care for a period of time because they maybe have a relative that they support. So it is a commitment. Obviously, when you have a child placed, then you're committed to that child, but it doesn't mean that you can't dip in and out of it, because there is that flexibility if you were looking at a respite or a short-term placement.
Okay, and what position will the child be in? What social position or lifestyle position will the child be in when they're referred for fostering?
That could be anything. So you could be a tiny, tiny baby. You could be an older teen who just needs that little bit of support towards independence. So it could be anything. But we would always risk assess and look to really well match that child with the carer who are in the best position to support them.
Okay, and what sort of home life do you have to be a foster parent?
Again?
Single, you can have children yourself and what have you?
Yep, single, married, cohabiting, doesn't make a difference. Working full-time, working part-time. Obviously, if you're working full-time, that would impact on the age of the child placed with you. But yeah, absolutely open to all sorts.
Okay. How do you assess the success or, heaven forbid, the failure of a foster parent?
So we have quite a robust assessment process. So before anyone would become an approved foster carer, they would need to get references from people they know who would then be able to say, yeah, they thought that person was in a good position to foster. They would need to get references from their employer if they were in work to say that they would be able to be a foster carer. We would then do an assessment which looks at lots of things. So lifestyle, home life balance, that sort of thing. Can you have the time and offer that support for children? We also provide some training in order that people actually do understand that some of the children that may come into foster care may have had some difficult experiences and we may see some behaviour. So they are trained to be able to manage that and to support those young people. We need to do some statutory checks, so police checks, things like that, health checks. So that takes a number of months, usually between 6 to 9 months kind of maximum. And then they will go to a fostering a panel and then they will become approved carers.
The children bear no responsibility in this because to a large extent the children have been pushed into a world that they didn't want, didn't deserve. So this is going to take somebody who's got a lot of understanding and a lot of love to give, surely.
Absolutely, yeah. But actually seeing the children, and I was very, very lucky to spend some time with some of our children in foster care in the lead up to Christmas. And I had the most enjoyable evening I've had in a long time. I've never seen such a bunch of absolutely wonderful children. I've actually got some feedback from our current foster carers who were just saying that actually some of the things that they've really, really benefited from is watching the children thrive in structure and routine. A lot of the children who come into foster care maybe haven't experienced that structure and routine that children really thrive from. So, you know, watching them being able to experience beautiful parts of our island that maybe they've not had a chance to see, finding just fostering is just so very fulfilling.
How many foster parents are you short?
We're not short of foster parents. So at the moment, similar to how you mentioned in the late 90s, we were looking for 88 families, or there was 88 children requiring care.
New readers start here, by the way. I was mentioning to Africa when I started doing Man in Line at the end of, it was 1998, we did a feature and stood outside on Douglas Head and released 88 balloons because there were 88 children looking for foster carers on the Isle of Man. That was then. I mentioned that. I mean, is there a shortfall at the moment? What happens when you can't find foster parents? What happens to the children and young people?
Okay. So we have, on average, about 70 to 80 children, sometimes up towards 100 children at any one time who are cared for outside of their families on the Isle of Man. So, and we have 21 mainstream carers, and we have about another 9 or 10 family and friends carers. So we will always look to family first to look after a child. So if parents, for whatever reason, aren't in a position to look after that child, will always consider family and friends. And we have family and friends who are paid carers to support their relatives.
And that's the point, is that you're not expecting people to do this for free. It's not what you call a lucrative earning, a lucrative living, but there is recompense for this, isn't there?
There is, yep. So there is a fostering fee and a skills fee for foster carers who do additional training, which would then cover the kind of needs of the child, so they would not be out of pocket.
Okay, we're here today with Teresa Cope, Chief Exec of Manx Care. Afric Edwards is here from Adoption and Fostering. So if you want to talk to either of them, by all means, call, text, email and WhatsApp. Let's get, first of all, to Teresa. I think Carla's with us today. Hi, Carla.
Hi.
You're live with Teresa Cope.
Hi, Carla.
Fantastic, thank you. Hi, how are you doing, Teresa?
Good, thank you. How are you, Carla?
Oh, fab. I'm good, thank you. I have a number of questions for you. And they have a little bit of background so everyone understands the lead up to the question. My concerns are regarding home births and the support of home births on the island. My dad was born in Colby about 90 years ago. And my grandfather had to jump on his motorbike. I presume he went to Douglas to call the doctor or midwife or both. And he was delivered at home. That was normal back in the day. Now, about 2 years ago, I was told that there weren't sufficient staff to support a home birth service for myself. And at the time, I understood, I sympathised. I was like, fair enough, we don't want anyone to be at risk. I'm now in the same position, and I've become aware that there are many other women on the island in the same position. And whenever they inquire about it, they just get shut down. They just get told, we don't provide that service. We can't provide that service. So in April 2021, just after Manx Care was launched, you told Islanders in a video that over time we would see improvements to our services and that Manx Care, I quote, would engage with you to get your views so that what we want from health and care is actually delivered. So 5 years later, from that 2021 video, which promises improvements based on public feedback, and 3 years after the Ombudsman ruled that you were breaking the law, home births are still suspended because of staff shortages.
Okay, all right. And let's let Teresa answer then. Home births, Teresa Cope.
Yeah, so we recognise that position, and I don't dispute anything that Carla has just shared. We recognise that we would love to be able to be in a position to support home births here on the island, but we are not able to do that until we are in a position where we've got safe and consistent and sustainable staffing levels in our Jane Crockall maternity unit. It is something that is improving. So we have had some great success in recruiting midwives to the island, and also investing in training of our homegrown midwives, which has had some success. So, you know, whilst I don't have a date by which we can reinitiate the home birth service, it is something that remains at the top of our agenda at the board in an attempt to get sustainable midwifery services here on the island. But, you know, I do sympathise. I do recognise we're not offering that choice of home birth. And it is something that we continue to look at to be able to do in the future, okay, but don't have a date yet.
Is it any sort of priority, Teresa?
It is. It is up there because we do recognise it's a choice. And the NHS Act, as Carla has said, it's a statutory responsibility of the NHS to offer that choice, but it can't be at the expense of being able to operate a safe maternity service here on the island.
Can you tell us roughly how many personnel you're short of being able to provide home births?
Well, I think we're down to less than five vacancies for midwives. So certainly about 18 months ago, we were in double figures in terms of the number of vacancies we have for midwives. That has reduced. And like I say, we're training our own as well. So I do anticipate the situation to further improve over the next 12 months.
Okay, Carla?
That's fab. So do we need, how many more midwives do we actually need? How many are we short? Because at the moment, it looks like, according to the legislation, there's no specific number and it's for Manx Care to decide. So how do you decide?
Yeah, so it is difficult. There is a maternity staffing tool which we use in order to be able to describe that. And of course, what we don't know at this point in time is how many women would take up the choice of having a home birth. You know, Carla, if this is something you clearly feel really passionately about, and I'm more than happy to sort of extend those conversations offline, because we can give you an update on perhaps our plans and share the trajectory with you.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Good to hear from you, Carla. Thanks for that. If Carla wants to get in touch with you, Teresa, what do we do?
Yeah, just phone Noble Switchboard and come through to my office, and we'll schedule and point Carla in the right direction for the team who can answer her questions and perhaps talk that through in a bit more detail.
Okay, let's go to Stephen. Hello, Stephen. You're live with Teresa Cope.
Good afternoon, Andy. Good afternoon, your guests, and good afternoon to your listeners. I'd like to ask you, please, Chief Executive, what are you actually doing? You've never had so much money in this latest allocation, and yet Ear, Nose and Throat Clinic has not got 1 year of a wait time. There's cases where people have told me they're waiting 4 years. Now, that, I'm sure you will agree, is completely unacceptable. And what I'd like to ask is, what are you going to do to implement a reduction in the wait times for this speciality?
Okay, thank you, Stephen. Thank you for your question. And we do recognise that ENT has had some very specific pressures. Those have been sustained throughout the time of Manx Care, and we know those waiting times are acceptable. I would suggest they're not 4 years. Within ENT, we have a large number of both urgent and 2 week wait patients, which ultimately do mean that patients who are referred as routine do wait longer. We do recognise that's not an acceptable wait, and there are plans in place moving forward to address that. You know, one of the things we're attempting to do, and we have got funding in this year's allocation to do that, is to have a comprehensive validation of the waiting list. So basically clinically review everybody on the waiting list and be able to put a treatment plan in place for those patients to be seen. Potentially some of those patients could be referred to Liverpool, but also to look at reducing the amount of patients who are within the ENT service who are being followed up. So we know we lack the level of capacity for new patients because of the rate of patients that are in the system being followed up. Now, we have recognised that some of those patients don't need to be followed up quite as often. Some of them might not be needed to be followed up at all. And so something called patient-initiated follow-up is going to be launched, as well as using the principles of getting it right first time, GERFT, to be able to put in some of those standards and indeed clinically validate the waiting list. So the position will improve. The additional investment needed to do that has come through in our settlement for this year. So I hope that helps, Stephen.
Well, no, it doesn't help, actually. I'm waiting 16 months. Other people I know have been waiting much longer. I don't accept what you say that it's not 4 years, because I only have anecdotal evidence, and I'm not one to disbelieve somebody when they say it. So for me, I'm afraid unless Manx Care gets its act together, I, for one, would be lobbying my MHK for it to be disbanded, because it's not doing what it says on the tin. And if I wanted somebody else in any other field and they don't come up with the goods, we get rid of them. Do you not agree with that? So I'm not being disrespectful to you, but if you're not solving the problems, well, why should we keep you?
Yeah, I completely accept that. I think the problems are complex. It's not just about throwing money at some of these issues. If all the issues were solved by money, it would probably be a different conversation. Stephen, I'm very happy to look at your particular case offline in terms of why you're waiting, and continue that conversation if you wish. But there has been some specific problems within the ENT service, and that we are actively addressing.
Okay, a final word, Stephen.
I don't want any special treatment. I want to be just dealt with as any other patient should be, speedily. Everything you read about ears, etc., says get them treated speedily, get the diagnoses. So I agree it's not throwing money at it, it's throwing consultants. importance at it to get us all seen. That's what we want.
Okay, all right, Stephen, we appreciate that. And it comes about, well, and again, am I wrong in saying, Teresa, it is all about money? Is it about money or is it about finding skilled people, recruitment? Which bit is it?
It's always a bit of both. And every specialty will have a different set of issues that we're trying to resolve. You know, within ENT, it's a very high volume specialty. We definitely, and this is why Restoration and Recovery 3 a couple of years back was focused, because actually if you do need surgery, the waiting time for surgery post your outpatient is actually quite short. But what we're lacking is the outpatient capacity. ENT is a particular hard to recruit to specialty, but also we know that the sort of getting it right first time principles and validation will really help that position. So, you know, I do absolutely sympathise with Stephen's position. It wouldn't be special treatment, it would just be understanding and giving him an explanation, and probably the assurance about where he is on the waiting list, when he's likely to be seen, and perhaps the reason why he has been waiting, and whether there is a need to expedite that based on his clinical presentation. But that would be happening through the validation exercise anyway.
Okay, could you ask Teresa Cope? This is Tim, who WhatsApped in to say, are there any plans to introduce the drug, to make the drug Entresto available on the Isle of Man for patients with left ventricle heart failure? I have this issue after a failed triple bypass almost 4 years ago. I've been advised by at least 3 cardiac consultants at Nobles that I need this drug. Unfortunately, they're not allowed to prescribe it on the Isle of Man. The drug's freely available in the UK, on the NHS and across the world. From Tim.
Yeah. So this will be a drug which comes under the banner of NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. And I think we've spoken here a few times about how the island has been quite far behind England in this. So NICE was implemented in England around 22 years ago. We have been steadily implementing NICE and the particular drug your caller mentions. We've just agreed a new framework, which has been put together by our executive medical director, which means we will start rolling out more NICE. Again, very happy to have a conversation with this caller offline and connect him with Dr. Stockport to be able to give some timelines about when that particular drug is likely to be introduced. But it is something we're very conscious of. We need to be able to offer NICE-based drugs and technologies here on the island and catch up. But of course, there is always a cost to that. But again, this year should allow us to make a little bit more progress than what we have done in the last couple of years.
Okay, Tim, if you want to get in touch, call the hospital. I also speak to Teresa Cope. Tell her, whoever you speak to, that you've spoken to her on Man in Line, and we'll move it on from there. Margaret in Braddon says, I'm currently going through dermatology services for a skin condition I've got. The service is based at Peel GP. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned over the last year is that none of the GP surgeries are on the same system. For example, the dermatologist will send me a prescription, but my GP won't be able to see what this is unless I tell them. It also doesn't show up on the NHS app, because it's not the registered GP. Also, blood test results only get sent to the GP which made the request. If I want my GP to see the results, I've either to have them posted or go to the surgery and collect the results in person, then show the doctor. Is this ever going to change? Why aren't they on the same system? There's so much onus on the patient to inform each doctor what's going on, which could be dangerous if there's any misunderstandings. That's Margaret in Braddon.
Yep, completely recognise what Margaret's saying and the frustrations there. This all links back to the Manx Care Record. So we absolutely recognise, as an integrated health and social care system, including our contractors, we are all on different clinical systems. That makes it difficult to transfer information, to transfer clinical information. We don't have electronic prescribing, so prescriptions can't transfer electronically. We are way behind where we would want to be in terms of that technology. So we've talked endlessly about something called the Manx Care Record, this single integrated patient record, which will sit across all of our services, connect them up, and will make things easier, including things like electronic transfer of prescription. It is still sat with the transformation team attempting to get approval. We're at outline business case stage at this moment in time and hoping to make some good progress on it over the next 12 months. We are trying to get the full business case in front of Tim Wald before the recess.
How frustrating is that for you and for people involved?
I think it's hugely frustrating. I mean, you know, the Jonathan Michaels report of 2019 was very clear. This was one of the key fundamental requirements of that transformation programme. Colleagues tell me that even before the Sir Jonathan Michaels report, the single Manx care record had been talked about for the previous 10 years at least. We are now in 2026 and we still do not have that single electronic record. It's frustrating for everybody. It's particularly frustrating for clinicians who have to have multiple systems, multiple logins. And it's, you know, as Margaret said, it's frustrating for patients to be on the receiving end when care is not joined up in that way. So yes, it's horribly frustrating for all clinicians. And if we could just do one single thing in the next 12 months, which would make a massive difference to patients and clinicians, it would be let's get that Manx care record progressed.
How much would it cost to do it, Teresa?
We're talking
hundreds of thousands? Millions?
We're talking millions, tens of millions. Yeah.
It's not just a new computer then, obviously.
It's not just a new computer. So the new computer bit is the easy bit. What sits behind the implementation of a new EPR is a massive amount of a change programme which needs many professionals, often clinical background professionals. So it needs a significant team. So, you know, just buying the system through procurement is probably the easy bit. It is the implementation, and we know from watching across, it can go horribly wrong if you don't do it right.
Okay, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years for it?
I would love to see it within the next 2 to 3 years, I think is realistic in terms of beyond procurement, supplier selected, mobilisation commenced.
Okay, I got a message in just said, are you seriously telling me, Andy, we can get speak to Teresa Cope by calling the switchboard at Nobles? Well, it's not that simple, but it's the first thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I get calls put through to my office all the time. My PA, Natalie, will probably kill me for saying this, but that's how you get hold of me. You know, I'm part of the exec on call. I am contactable. I have a direct line. There are ways and means of contacting me, and patients, relatives, others contact me every day via that route. Okay. I am accessible.
Teresa Cope is here, Chief Exec of Manx Care, also Afric Edwards from Adoption, Fostering and Adoption. What's the telephone number, Afric, if anybody wants to find out more about adoption and fostering?
Yeah. If you want to find out, you can contact us on 610000. You can also access our inquiry forms on the gov.im page if you look up fostering. And we also have a Facebook page under Family Placement Service.
Okay. Is there a website or is it just a Facebook page?
So the website is the gov.im one.
Okay. What's the longest anybody's been? What's the longest serving foster parent you've got on the Isle of Man?
So we've got a couple of them now who are over the 25-year mark.
Any idea how many children they've seen?
I'm not sure. I haven't got those figures.
Just there was one of the ladies, when going back to the 88 balloons, there was a lady who I think there had been 100,
yeah,
over 100 children. She'd been doing it for years and years and years. And tell me, what do you think foster parents learn about themselves by being a foster parent?
I think they find it really, really beneficial. I think that the feedback we've got from our foster carers is just that giving back and learning what the children can teach them. You can learn an awful lot from a child. So watching those children grow and thrive, I think just is really, really beneficial for everybody.
I particularly remember one couple who we spoke to who said they'd had children and their children had grown up, but they felt they'd still got something to give. Is that quite common?
Yes, absolutely. So that there's quite a few people who've come to us sort of later on in life, sort of late 50s, early 60s, and gone back into fostering, whose kids have maybe, as you say, left home or gone off to university. And, you know, that emptiness syndrome is a real thing, actually. If you've got that space in your home, you've got that time to give, why not consider fostering?
Okay. Right, back in just a few moments' time with Teresa Cope and Afric Edwards from Manx Care.
Carpetland, the carpet specialist with the island's best value carpets in stock. Often fitted within a week. Furnitureland for three-piece suites, dining and living room furniture and a selection of amazing beds. Carpetland and Furnitureland, West Street, Ramsey.
Drive smarter. Drive more reliable. Drive a great deal at Manin Motors. With a superb range of cars for every budget, always available. And if we don't have it, we'll source it. Plus, servicing, valeting and prestige detailing too. Manin Motors, Richmond Hill, Douglas. Find us on Facebook or call 420-420. That's 420-420. Drive a better bargain at Manin Motors.
Whatever your business, whatever its size, you can always rely on the island's leading fuel and oil supplier to keep you moving. Ellen Vannin Fuels, powering the island and powering industry. Call us on 844-000.
Elevate Rubber Cover from Rubber Roof Shop for one-piece flat roofing systems. No joins, no leaks. We also line commercial box gutters in one piece up to 60 metres with a 20-year written warranty against leakage. Call Rubber Roof Shop on 49667.
Above deck or below, Harbour Marine Services has all your boating needs in one place. From engine sales and servicing to charts, books, dinghies and trailers, electronics, navigation, ropes, rigging and safety. Over 2,000 square feet of stock to help you stay safe on the water. Call 822-995 or find us on Facebook. For all your chandlery supplies, set your course to Harbour Marine Services, next to Castle Down Harbour.
Are you a small charity here on the Isle of Man? Are you looking for volunteers, hoping to raise awareness and chasing those crucial pounds and pennies to support your work? Well, Manx Radio can help. You could be our next 1-3 Charity of the Week. With daily on-air coverage, podcast and social media promotion, we can help support you and those you help. Just email the numbers 123@manxradio.com and listen out for the feature each weekday between 1 and 3pm. The Charity of the Week, brought to you by Kell Properties.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Teresa Copas here, the boss of Manx Care, Afric Edwards from Fostering and Adoption, and there's a note in from 553 who says, what's happening to Ramsey Cottage Hospital? It's awful that the elderly have to be in nobles when Ramsey was so good for the North. What's the situation?
Yep. So yes, we've got some significant issues with the building at Ramsey District Cottage Hospital. So that started on Martin Ward, and we had some infestation issues. But when the Department of Infrastructure colleagues attempted to do that work, other significant issues were found with the building. It is a very old building, and we need to make sure it is absolutely safe in order to deliver patient care from that site. So it was very unfortunate that, you know, just the other side of Christmas, we had to relocate all the services that were in the Cottage Hospital. And that scheme of work is now going to take longer to put right all of the things that have been identified. So, yes, it is really inconvenient for both staff and patients. We are committed to maintaining services up in Ramsey. It's strategically important for the organisation and linked to our wellbeing hub as well. So
you always get asked this every time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is Ramsey Cottage Hospital safe?
It will be, but it does need preventative maintenance work doing and getting up to the right standard for a health building. You know, over time, the sort of standards and then compliance levels and what needs to be in place to run services, particularly those services when you're thinking about theatres, you're operating on people, we do renal dialysis up there. So there are a range of services where we have to make sure the environment and the building is safe for those services to continue.
Okay, could you ask Teresa Coe if she will provide a full-time GP at the Southern Group practice to improve waiting times?
We're in discussions on that at the moment, and yes, we will be supporting Southern Group. We're in meetings with them in the very near future to be able to support that practice to stabilise and
You ask Teresa Coe what she thinks of the government's intention to increase the population of the Isle of Man if Manx Care is struggling at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, we've just done some work to essentially look at the demographics of the population and to understand what service needs are going to prevail over the next 5 to 10 years. Actually, our demographic plans, and I think this links back to some of the work that Mr. Kane has done, does show that actually the birth rate is likely to continue reducing over the next 5 years, but equally the population is due to reduce over the next 5 years. However, the number of people over 55 is going to increase. So that tells you the types of services that we're going to need. Yes, if you're expanding the population, there needs to be greater infrastructure. Many of the challenges that we've got around moving services out into the community are linked to we need buildings and a state that make it possible to do so. You know, we've got plans to do more home first, move services in the community. But just like the issue with the cottage hospital, we have to make sure we've got buildings that are fit for delivering modern healthcare from in the community.
You prompted the next question. That was from Carey, who said, is Nobles Hospital going to get extensions? Will you be building more onto Nobles Hospital? There's skeet going round that you're going to build on the Millennium Oakwood and build an extension to the hospital there.
Oh, well, that's news to me, Andy. So yes, I mean, effectively, we've used all of the space within Nobles now. We don't have any spare wards. We don't have any spare areas. We have a business case going through process at the moment because we have talked frequently about the emergency department needing to be bigger than what it is. It's half the size it needs to be for the number of patients going attending the emergency department. And equally, some of the configuration of Nobles needs to change. Over the last year, we've been changing the sort of configuration of some of the wards in order to meet the standards for contemporary modern healthcare. But yes, inevitably, we are going to have to look at building out from the Nobles site in order to meet the demand.
And the only spare land is the Millennium Oakwood.
Yeah, but I don't think, you know, I don't think we've got that far yet.
You mentioned ED, and that must be a frustration. Also, it's stressful for patients. It's stressful for the personnel who are working in the ED. Everybody knows the anecdotal stories. What's the short term and the long term answer for ED?
Yep. So in the short term, it is about the clinical decisions unit opening, which will come online in the next 3 or 4 weeks. And that will allow patients who are unlikely to be admitted to hospital but still need urgent and emergency care to be treated in a different area other than the emergency department. And we're also going to be relocating the fracture clinic in order to give additional waiting space for the ED. So we're creating a slightly bigger footprint for the emergency department based on what we've got available already by moving some services around. It's not ideal, but it will relieve some of the problems. What we should have, what we ideally would want to have, is a separate waiting room for paediatric patients. You know, we shouldn't have paediatrics waiting alongside other patients. You know, there are all different presentations in ED, and it's really, really important from a safeguarding and from a patient experience that we're able to accommodate different people's needs in a waiting room environment. So the clinical decisions unit will really help. That's a very significant change, which will allow us to see patients who probably don't require coming into hospital, but they certainly need probably a suite of diagnostic tests, some assessment and management plans put in place.
Okay, let's go back to the phones now. Richard's with us. Hi, Richard. Thanks for hanging on. You're with Teresa Cope from Manx Care.
Right. Thank you very much, Andy. It's good to be able to speak to Teresa. I and my family are hugely grateful for all my cancer surgery, radiotherapy and other hospitalisations, which have in fact extended my life by about 15 years. However, do you accept that we in the Isle of Man are paying over 20% more per head of population for our health care than is paid in England, and yet we often have cruel waiting lists, which are sometimes twice as long as theirs.
Thank you, Richard, and I'm pleased to sort of hear you got great care and you're enjoying life. I don't recognise that number of 20% more than England. It's quite difficult to compare, and this is some of the work that Sir Jonathan Michaels did back in 2019. There are certain things which sit within the costs of Manx care that perhaps sit outside of the same healthcare costs and profiles for England. So obviously social care is integrated in the Isle of Man, whereas that would be subject to local authorities in England. And equally, we have other things which would sit in social security, which sit in Manx Care's baseline budget, and we're responsible for that. So the Sir Jonathan Michaels report did suggest that healthcare costs were slightly higher, but that is sort of the economies of scale of delivering things in a small island setting. There is an acceptance that when you're delivering healthcare on an island, your costs are going to be higher. You don't have the economies of scale. You need all the lifelines and connectivity to England, and indeed sometimes you can't do with just half of something. You need to make it sustainable. So we do recognise that there is an inherent cost associated with delivering care on an island that you wouldn't have in England, but equally the construct of England and the economies of scale are different. So, okay. Yeah,
Richard, what was your specific point, Richard, about waiting lists?
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that a dog would be treated quicker than many on our waiting list, and that this causes a widespread discontent with the management of Manx Care, which is so unfairly counters the wonderful work of Teresa's excellent frontline medical staff, especially since a paper was recently prepared suggesting that cataract patients should be requested to pay for their own lenses, which the paper said cost between £750 and £1,000 for a basic lens, when it subsequently was discovered that the lens only cost £58.
Okay, Teresa?
Yeah. So I think that's...
I don't think dogs get on the National Health, to be quite honest.
No, I think, you know, there are the questions around how we construct a system which addresses the waiting list. But I think Richard's point specifically is in relation to sort of that part funding
right.
by the patient for which would, you know, allow income generation and potentially allow more investment into services to allow those waiting lists to reduce. Again, I understand the debate on that. That is something which is fundamentally a government policy decision, which Manx Care is not able to sort of influence. It wouldn't be down to us to make that decision. But we do absolutely recognise that the waiting list positions across a number of our specialties aren't where we would want them to be, and that waiting lists for routine patients have grown in favour of more prompter services for urgent and emergency patients and indeed cancer patients. So, you know, as I spoke about earlier with Stephen's calls, we are committed to try and get those outpatient waiting lists in a much better shape over the next 12 months, and indeed have had the investment now to be able to progress that work.
Okay, Richard, good to hear. How are you keeping these days, Richard, by the way?
Oh, I'm not too bad, thank you.
All right, good.
There's any concern from other people that the waiting list might be being kept long in order to enable the private providers and others to continue to make huge profits?
Yeah, no, I'm aware that that could be interpreted, but there's absolutely no intention to bring back, you know, the private providers. I think you're obviously referring to Synaptic. No, there is no gaming or artificial management of the waiting list, which is trying to produce a situation whereby independent sector or private providers would come into that market. Absolutely not.
Okay, Richard, we appreciate your call. Hope you continue with good health. And 228 says, Andy, could you ask Teresa Cote why Smile Dental Practice has stopped taking appointments for existing patients and why is it not open when it was supposed to be open by now?
Yeah, Smile Dental is very topical at the moment. Just before the Easter bank holiday, they stopped delivering a service. We're in contractual discussions with Smile Dental at the moment, which I probably can't talk about in too much detail. Smile were one of the providers affected by the Ramsey District Cottage Hospital change, and they were given alternative premises from which to deliver their services. We have made sure that if you're receiving care at Smile Dental, you can access urgent emergency dental treatment via the CDS, and some comms have gone out on that. But we're currently looking at what the solutions look like for those patients registered with Smile Dental, whether that will mean Smile will come back onto the island and start delivering their service again, or whether Manx Care will step in and put some alternative arrangement in place. But they are active discussions. I know my team are in meetings this afternoon, both contractually and providing an operational solution for that, and we should be able to communicate something in the next few days.
Okay, let's go to Ali, who's with us now. Hi, Ali.
Oh, hi. You had a caller a bit earlier who was talking about ENT waiting lists, etc., etc.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear Ms. Cope's response to why, out of the blue, I had a telephone call yesterday. I'm not sure if it was a consultant or just somebody in admin, but they've been given a horrendous burden of having to phone probably over 200 people to check to see if they still need ENT services, because he said to me, well, you were referred in November 2020. Now, the only thing I can think is I have a condition the same as my sister. We have a lot of nosebleeds, probably pretty much every day. And at the time, I must have been, I'd had probably a blood test, etc., saying that my hemoglobin was very low. And I must have been referred by my doctor. Mm. But I just live with it because I'd heard nothing further. And you just, day to day, you just live with it. And I'd be interested to hear what your response is, Miss Cope.
Okay, so I don't know the specifics of your case, Ali, but I think what sounds like it's happening is the validation that I spoke about is starting to happen. It's really important in the NHS we have what we call clean waiting lists. So we absolutely know that everybody on the waiting list still requires care, is being actively monitored whilst on the waiting list, and that we can both record and report an accurate waiting time and waiting list volume. That hasn't been the case on the island. And it hasn't been the case consistently across all specialties. And what consultants should ideally do is validate waiting lists at least twice every year with the organisation's support. And that is the work that we have been attempting to get the funding to do, and we now have. So what I suspect happened yesterday, Ale, was that we have started both the non-clinical validation of the ENT waiting list by contacting everybody who we have on our record and seeing whether they still need to be seen. What we found through validating other specialties is a lot of people either don't need the appointment or have had treatment elsewhere or presented via a different route. And in some specialties, between 30 and 40% of those people contacted have not required their appointment. And you know, combined with the fact that we do still have a DNA rate which is higher than what we would like, we do need to go through that whole program of improving the outpatient, both the processes, the administration, and the experience for those on the receiving end. So again, Ali, I'm happy to have the conversation offline, but I suspect what you were contacted about yesterday was the start of that administrative validation process, wanting to understand whether you still would wish to be seen in clinic.
Okay, Ali, do you still need to be
seen? I just wanted to say that you're extremely articulate with your responses with everything, but the fact remains that 5.5 years... there's probably a lot of other people that probably do need. I've just said, look, let somebody else have my appointment or whatever. I said, because I'm just living with this. Mm. But it really is not acceptable that after 5 years, you've said that they review it a couple of times a year. Obviously, this has not happened.
Yeah, no, that's what they should do. That's what best practice would say, Ali. And I completely agree. The ENT position is unacceptable. It's the worst specialty in terms of that overall position, and there is a plan to address that. But yes, I do hope
that this chap that's having to do this job, I felt so sorry for him because he said, look, I'm trying to help. And I said, I appreciate that. I said, it's the system that has put you in this position. And I said, I really do hope that you are appreciated for the work you're having to do now, because it's just unfair that he's having to do that. But he's, I take my hat off to him.
Yeah.
And as I say, I did feel for him. So.
No, but thank you, Ali.
Okay, appreciate it, Ali. Thanks. And that in a microcosm is, I've got a few messages. Alan dropped a note in and he kind of expresses it and just says, nobody has any issue with frontline people within Manxcare because everybody's doing their job and behind it. And you get this all the time, Teresa Cope. You probably get more criticism, almost more than the bloke who's responsible for the horse trams. Everything seems to be your fault.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing I can't do, mustn't do, would never do is try and change clinical behaviour. These are systems and process issues that we need to address. And, you know, every specialty has challenges, all probably have different solutions. I could potentially go and recruit more ENT surgeons tomorrow, but we're talking a significant amount of money. And when we need to work through the issues that we have currently in that specialty.
Okay, that's about it. We've almost run out of time. Afric's still with us today. What was the telephone number again, Afric, for adoption and fostering?
610000.
610000. Well, thanks to everybody who called. Everybody, I keep getting messages saying, I can't get through. It's just the lines were blocked. It was very, very busy today. And for everybody whose question we couldn't get to, sorry about that. So, Teresa, we'll see you in a few months' time, Teresa.
Happy to come back whenever, Andy.
Okay, good to see you. Thanks, Afric. Good to see you today. If you want to follow up on anything, by all means, do get in touch. You can email maninline@manxradio.com out of hours, call the answer phone on 682631. Or we're back tomorrow. Open line from 12 through till 1. In the meantime, thanks to Chris on the phones today. Thank you for getting involved. And we'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Thursday and make sure you stay dry. WINT